podcast, NAMM 2012 Special, Day 2 with Jen Gupta. Hello and welcome to the Jogcast. I'm Jen and I'm here on Day 2 of the National Astronomy Meeting in Manchester. Today I'll be going to talks on high-energy astrophysics, cosmic carbon, outreach and hopefully lots more. And I'll be trying to bring you short interviews with as many speakers as possible so that you can get a flavour of what's going on today. One of the sessions this morning was on outreach and one of the speakers in that session was Dr. Rob Simpson from Oxford University, who was talking about planet hunters. And now I've managed to grab him and Chief Zookeeper Dr. Chris Lintott in the corridor. So Rob, could you tell us a bit about your talk today?
Yeah, I was talking about, we collaborated at the Zooniverse with BBC Stargazing Live, which was here. It was in Jodrell Bank. And we found an exoplanet. So we took 3 days. We had a million classifications on planethunters.org. And over 100,000 people took part. And we helped discover an exoplanet, or technically an exoplanet candidate, but a very good candidate.
We've got keck time, hopefully, this week. There's a pesky background we found out. We saw the transit, we saw the dip in light when the planet gets in front of its parent star, and that's what Threppleton and Holmes and their friends on Stargazing Live helped us do.
Yeah, so Lee Threppleton and Chris Holmes were the two members of the public that first spotted two of the separate transit events for this exoplanet during the 3 days of Stargazing Live.
But the trick is we need to rule out there's a pesky background star that's just close enough that could be faking the transits. If it's an eclipsing binary, if it's two stars going around each other. And so we've used UKIRT data with the help of the Kepler team, and now we need to get Keck on it, and hopefully we can turn it from a planet candidate into a proper plant. Anyway, that's what Rob was talking about.
Can we back up a sec? So planet hunters use Kepler data, is that right?
Yes, planet hunters, you're looking at light curves from Kepler. The Kepler spacecraft is staring at about 100,000 stars. Very, very sensitive instrument. So I'm always told that it could see a mosquito passing in front of a headlight, which I guess is a slightly useful analogy. But it's very, very sensitive. And if you're aligned such that the planet going around the star is between you and the star, then you'll see a slight dip in the light as the planet goes across. And those are the dips that users on the Planet Hunters website are trying to mark and find and tell us they're there.
How many have you found so far?
Planet candidates, I'm not sure what the total is now.
Candidates were well over 100. Actual planets, published ones, we've just got paper with numbers 3 and 4 is nearly accepted. I'll be talking about those tomorrow, so this is a sneak preview. And then we've got a long list of other candidates. We're finding that people are particularly good at finding weird and wonderful planets. And so we made do you remember there was that planet discovered last summer going around a binary star?
Yeah, the Tatooine.
That's the one. Yeah, absolutely. So we had an independent discovery of that, which doesn't count for anything because we weren't quick enough. But we think our users are particularly good at finding those because the presence of the two stars confuses the computer, the algorithms that the Kepler team use. And so we're just getting to the point where we can follow up on these because the patch of sky that Kepler's staring at is in Cygnus, summer constellation in the northern hemisphere, and so it's just getting to the point where you can observe it from Hawaii. And so we've got some follow-up lined up over the summer, and we hope we'll have plenty more planets soon.
And Planet Hunters is one of many Zooniverse projects. Are there any others that you'd like to talk about?
We should definitely talk about the Milky Way project.
The Milky Way project is a sort of bubble hunting, if you like the analogy. We've got Spitzer data, beautiful images of these star-forming regions, all in the galactic plane of the Milky Way. And we're asking people to draw bubbles and to find other objects in that data. And they've been doing that it launched at about the same time as Planet Hunters did. So it's December 2010. And we've created astronomy's largest catalogue of infrared bubbles. So there's a talk later about that, in fact. And there's a poster up here at NAMM. This is good doing NAMM. NAMM podcasting. And the Milky Way project has moved into a sort of second phase now, where users on the site are seeing the catalogue of bubbles that they helped discover. So we've entered a sort of meta Milky Way project where people are seeing all these gorgeous bubbles and they're now taking more precise measurements so that we can do better science. And one of the things we want to get out of this is to understand how stars form. We want to know if stars trigger the formation of other stars. And we want to understand the dynamics and the properties of the interstellar medium, that beautiful nebulous material you often see in images.
The only thing I'd add is that it's really cool for me, at least, because we've had Galaxy Zoo for nearly 5 years now, and that produced real scientific papers. But Planet Hunters has papers, Solar Stormwatch has papers, Milky Way Project is now producing real results. One project that hasn't yet, because we need more people's help, is the Galaxy Zoo Mergers Project.
Yes.
This is where we're getting people to smash galaxies together on their computer and fiddle with the simulations and see if you can match an observed merger. Now, we're nearly there. We've taken a close look at 100 mergers. We've had more than 5 million simulations run on people's computers. But we're sort of in, what is this, the Christmas special of Galaxy Mergers. We've got the best of the best up against each other. And so we just relaunched the site. Don't laugh.
Sorry.
So we just relaunched the site. And if you want to see the most spectacular simulations of mergers and help us find the definitive ones that will go on to the grand final of being in a paper and helping us understand Galaxy Mergers, then we need people's help right now. And that's at mergers.galaxyzoo.org.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, you talked about we have other projects. Zooniverse.org has all the projects listed by category. There's lots of them. You'll find mergers there and all the others, and it's well worth a look. There's far more there than most people think there.
Just before we finish, you launched a new project recently called SETI Live, which is something different. You're actually getting live data, is that right, from the telescopes?
Yeah, I can't believe I didn't talk about SETI. Yeah, this is live data from the Allen Telescope Array. And so it's new for us because this is literally as the data comes off the telescope and we're looking for aliens. So with Jill Tarter, who many people know, who's the inspiration behind the main character in Contact, which is a film I grew up loving, and thinking that radio astronomers listened to...
They get me started on that.
Yeah, okay, fine.
we are in Manchester, near Central
sure.
Bank.
But SETI... So the point is that we're looking in crowded regions of the radio spectrum where there is a lot of interference, in which the computers at SETI have never been able to sort through. But we think if we can get people in the loop live and we can get a better understanding of what's going on, we may just find a signal. Obviously, the odds are, astronomical. But the telescope's there. It sends its data up to the website. And if somebody marks something and it's confirmed by other users, then within 3 minutes, we can get the telescope back and pointing at the signal again. It's very different from things like SETI at home, where they're mostly using archive data. So SETI Live's exciting because you might find aliens. It's exciting because it's live data. But it's also exciting because this sort of live mode is, I think, where the Zooniverse is going in the next few years. There's lots of places where putting human brains in the process of collecting data is going to be very important.
Well, thank you very much, Rob and Chris. I've got to say this is a little bit weird because it feels like I'm listening in on a recycled electrons recording. It's probably what our listeners feel like when they actually meet your customers.
Yeah, this is probably recycled electrons is our can we make a podcast with no effort.
Maybe we can.
Maybe we can. We can't aspire to be the Jodcast, but maybe we're the extra show, the extra half hour with wine tacked on the bottom.
The Jodcast
is
frozen.
That's right. There you go.
Well, thank you very much. Another of the sessions on this morning was on extragalactic transients, and I'm here with Tanner Joseph from Southampton University, who was speaking about some X-ray sources. Could you tell us about your talk?
I studied the elliptical galaxy NGC 4472, and we found three very interesting point sources in this galaxy. Two of them are definitely black holes, and one of them is a possible black hole candidate. In terms of my research, I really wanted to be a black hole so I can write a paper about it. And then the other two candidates are, one is the first black hole ever to be discovered in a globular cluster, and the other one is also another black hole in a globular cluster, because I think black holes in globular clusters are kind of like buses. You wait thousands of years for one to turn up, but then once one does, another one comes along 3 years later.
So a globular cluster, is that a group of stars within this galaxy?
Globular clusters are dense groups of stars, not within the galaxy itself, but orbiting around the galaxy like natural satellites.
Okay. And something that people always ask is, if they're black holes, how can you see them in X-rays? Could you explain that?
That's a very good question that I also get asked quite a lot. The way we detect them in X-rays is not... The X-rays aren't coming directly from the black hole, but they're coming from an accretion disk around the black hole, which is just a disk of really hot and energetic matter that's formed around the black hole, almost like we think about a drain, like in your bath, the plug, the water swirls around before it falls into the plug. It's like that.
And these black holes, are they stellar black holes, or are they like this kind of mass of our sun, or are these really big ones?
They are not the supermassive black holes, not the really big ones. They are, I guess, between the mass of our sun and about 50 or so solar masses. Yeah.
And where is this research going? So what can we find out about black holes and about these galaxies, Thomas?
Well, first of all, there's I wouldn't use the word controversy, but there is a very old paper that was written in 1969, and they said that this person put forward that black holes shouldn't exist in globular clusters because of the motions inside the globular clusters, they would actually be ejected.
All right.
And so people have sort of just gone by that and used that as sort of a gospel truth. And my supervisor dared to be different and actually found these black holes in the globular clusters where everyone just thought that they wouldn't exist there.
That's really interesting. Thank you very much for talking to us. Another of the sessions this morning was on cosmic carbon, and I'm here with Dr. Paul Woods to find out about his talk.
So today I talked about doing some chemical modelling of extragalactic carbon stars. So we have some observational evidence from Spitzer spectra. These are mid-infrared spectra that in carbon stars we see a very rich chemistry in the circumstellar regions, and we find very strong absorption features due to acetylene, which is a very important molecule when you're looking at the chemistry around carbon stars. It feeds a lot of other carbon chemistry, and we find lots of long carbon chain molecules forming. And so we see this sort of indirectly from observations, but nobody's really looked at what effect this has on the circumstellar chemistry and in the formation of complex molecules.
So you're looking around the stars, not actually at the stars?
Right, yes. So what we see in the Spitzer observations is the entire star, but the modelling that I've been doing is in the regions around the stars, yes, because they're the regions that are most interesting from a chemistry point of view. That's where we find all the large complex molecules.
And so what does this tell us about carbon stars?
This tells us a lot about the molecules that they produce and then push into the interstellar medium. And by observing these molecules, these complex molecules in some cases, we can find out a lot about the sort of physical parameters of the carbon stars as well, their temperatures, the rates at which they push out matter into space, and the densities and the radiation fields that we find in these galaxies as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm here with Professor Mike Edwards of Cardiff University, and you've been talking in the RAS community session about creating an astronomy museum. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, in a sense, a museum, but it may just be a virtual idea, an idea of a museum, not an actual museum. The idea is that we're trying to look at what do we do with all the stuff that's been created over the past century or so to do with astronomy. A lot of departments have equipment, records, memories about doing important astronomy research over that time. And yet we haven't really formulated a policy. People ask us, what do you do with that? And the problem is, if a head of department needs space in his department, one of the first things that may go is old equipment. Because space is expensive, recording it's expensive, and so on. And we're trying to have an effort over the next year or so to really get some idea of what the best way of recording stuff, preserving stuff, noting where stuff is, in order to preserve what is important for the future.
And is this something that amateur astronomy societies can get involved with?
Certainly. We'd certainly be interested in hearing from amateur societies, particularly if they have particular ideas how they would like to see things preserved and what they would like to be able to visit or access, either through the web or through visits and so on. And also, too, if they know of or have in their possession particular artefacts that they may want to keep and preserve, that's fine. But if we knew about it, it would allow people to do research on them or know about them if possible. And I know there are things in amateur possession which are important artefacts from the history of astronomy. So if also, too, if amateurs know about things locally that are going to be binned or recycled, as I suppose it'd be called these days, we'd be very interested to know. What we're trying to do is to set up a way of dealing with that. And in particular, the difficult thing about knowing how to assess whether we should or should not keep something. Should we record this or should we not? How do you have some idea about what's really going to be important for the future?
If people do have something that they think you might be interested in, is there a website or should they just get in touch with you?
The best thing is to contact us through the Astronomical Heritage Committee at the Royal Astronomical Society.
Brilliant, thank you very much.
Well, that wraps it up for day two of the National Astronomy Meeting. I hope you enjoyed this episode. The editor and producer of this show was Jen Gupta. So until tomorrow, jot on!